Today on Against the Grain, the untimely death of David Graeber, anthropologist, anarchist, and one of the initiators of Occupy Wall Street, has left an immeasurable void on the radical left. His friend and collaborator, Andrei Grubicic, joins me to reflect on Graeber's wide-ranging contributions, from the long history of debt and class society to the fundamental importance of generosity, care, and play in our lives, to how we might grasp the possibilities of life beyond capitalism. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. David Graeber, who died on September 2nd, was arguably the most important radical thinker of his generation. For a very long time, Graeber wrote, the intellectual consensus has been that we can no longer ask great questions. Increasingly, it's looking like we have no other choice. In that spirit, the author of Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and Direct Action, among other works, Graeber showed us how to think in new ways about the long sweep of class society, capitalism, and the communist potential in the here and now. Joining me from Croatia to discuss the singular legacy of David Graeber is Andrei Grubicic. He was a close friend and collaborator of David Graeber's. They authored a new introduction to Peter Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, which will be published by PM Press, and therefore I need to disclose my own connection to PM Press. Andrei Grubicic, by any measure, David Graeber was an enormously influential intellectual as well as activist. What were some of his contributions to the field of anthropology?
In terms of anthropology, David has contributed immensely to the development of several basic insights that his mentors, his not only supervisors, but mentors in the deeper sense, have left. David's most important mentor, in a certain sense, is a French anthropologist, Marcel Mauss, who died long time ago, but David was in an intellectual dialogue with him for most of his, for entire life of David's life as an anthropologist. And there were several things there that David has developed. One of the main things that he took from Marcel Mauss, who is the author of the famous book on gift, Essay on the Gift, is this idea of everyday communism or baseline communism. David did not believe that Marcel Mauss was talking about a gift as a unitary phenomenon. He believed there are at least three logics, intellectual, moral logics, that are underlining what we call the gift. One was hierarchy, the other was exchange, and third one was communism. And the interesting thing about Marcel Mauss that influenced David a great deal was that Mauss never believed in total systems. He believed that society is a sort of an amalgam of different possibilities that are possible at every possible time. So David took this idea of total prestation, which is hinted at in the Essay of the Gift, and then developed further in the ethnographic manual that Marcel Mauss published, that there is something called everyday communism. The term was never used by Marcel Mauss, but Marcel Mauss was talking against this idea of what David called mythic communism, namely that once upon a time we lived in the society of communism, communist society, and then that disappeared, and then we have to go back to that stage. David was very much against that, and he insisted that Mauss show communism not as a property arrangement, but as practice. Communism was an everyday practice, and the possibility of communism resides precisely in the fact that communism is all over around us. This is what we, in this essay that David and myself wrote together on mutual aid, there is a very similar thing in Kropotkin. The idea is that communism is around us. And it's not some future to which we are heading. It's a way of organizing life. Now, David had a very intriguing formulation that I think got him into trouble because people did not understand what he was saying. He would say that capitalism is a way of organizing communism, and that capitalism is a really bad way of organizing communism. What he meant to say is that capitalism is always dependent on communism, which is always present. And what we need to do is to find a different way, a better way of organizing communism, which is always in existence. Kropotkin referred to this by the term mutual aid. Marcel Mauss used the term communism, but again, as a practice, something that exists in practice and not as a property arrangement. This is what David called baseline communism, or everyday communism. So, everyday communism or baseline communism, the idea that society is always this amalgam of possibilities that are always, and each possibility, communism or different forms of hierarchy, money, all of these possibilities, gift, of course, they're always present and they're always possible. So this is what David took from Marcel Mauss. He insisted that gift is this hidden face of modernity that we completely and always deny, even though everything that we do, our civilization, the entire capitalist modernity, in a certain sense, exists because of the gift and because of the gifting relationships in the society. Now, David, in that sense, was extremely influenced by Mauss, and he developed Maussian ideas further. Another person in anthropology who influenced David a lot and with whom he was in active conversation was his mentor, in sense of direct supervisor, Marshall Salins. And Marshall Salins, who taught his whole life in Chicago, opposite of the School of Economics, developed this theory that everything in economics, well, economics as a discipline, economics as a way of thinking, really is just a development of medieval Christianity. So economy and most of the economic insights really are, in a certain sense, continuation of the Augustinian ideas of the fallen world, of the punished human, of the infinite desire. And this is a theme that Marshall Salins was pursuing in most of his work, and this is something that David took and developed further, and most notably in his book on kings with Marshall Salins, book that two of them co-wrote. It's one of the more recent publications that David had. Finally, there is a whole conversation in anthropology that was initiated by another person who was close to David, and that's Terry Turner. He was his supervisor or mentor in the School of Anthropology at Chicago University, and he was one of the so-called value people in Chicago. And he believed, he was probably the only Piagetian Marxist, and it was an incredibly interesting synthesis of Piaget and Marx. And David was or became involved into the in different theories of value through Terry Turner. And who was endlessly original, but unlike David, he did not write much. So he did not publish much. And David is, I think, very much responsible for making Turner's insights and very original ideas known to a larger public. All of this became part of David's first published book. And the name of that book is Towards an Anthropological Theory of Value, which in a certain sense, and it sounds wildly ambitious, but that's what David was. David was incredibly ambitious, and he was always creating new ways of looking at things that we talk about all the times. There was certain exhilaration always when you read David, because you read things or listen to him. You are reading or listening about things that you have been involved with or thinking about your whole life. And every time you read David or hear him speak, you find the sense that you are listening or hearing something completely new and tremendously exciting. And what David did in that book, which was published, I believe, in 2001, was to bring together Marx, Marcel Mauss, Piaget, and Vygotsky. All of that was an incredible and very interesting attempt at synthesis, and it created a new possibility of thinking about value. And in a certain sense, created a possibility for David, baseline, to use a term that he liked, for him to develop when he was writing his book that would make him eventually famous, world famous, and that's the book That First 5,000 Years, which was published later in 2011, in the age, as he liked to call it, of his academic exile, after he was fired from Yale, and he had to leave first for Goldsmiths and then from London School of Economics.
And I had the good fortune to speak to David Graeber about his book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, when it came out. And we're going to play a cut from that interview where he talks precisely about this notion of everyday communism.
Communism is the basis of all sociability. Obviously, in order to say that, you have to have a slightly different definition of communism than that largely thrown out. Let's call it small c communism. One of the reasons why we imagine all moral relations as debts is because we think of all transactions, all relations we have with one another, certainly all economic relations which involve transferring some kind of good or labor back and forth, as if they're matters of exchange. And economics teaches us to do this. But it becomes a habit. I mean, even those people who are arguing against economists, a sociologist, will often say, well, no, it is an exchange, but it's a moral exchange. It's not a, you know, self-interested exchange. But, you know, a lot of what we do with each other isn't exchange at all. And I really think it's important that we sort of take the blinkers off our eyes and look around at how we actually live our lives. Gibson Graham, for example, a feminist economist, have long since pointed out that, you know, capitalism isn't the way we live most of the time. Most actions we do aren't profit-oriented. We just tend to figure have ways that we don't think about, you know, most of what we do every day, which has nothing to do with capitalism. But I, you know, try to take that a little more systematically, and I pointed out that, well, there is actual exchange. It can take the form of gift exchange, or it can take the form of commodity buying and selling. You have hierarchical relations, which are not reciprocal at all. You know, if you give something to a superior and inferior, often it's just taken to mean you're expected to do it again. But you also have communistic relations, and in a way, communistic relations are the most fundamental because all other relations are built on them. By communistic relations, I mean very simply from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. In fact, when people are cooperating with one another, it doesn't matter where, you know, if you're working for ExxonMobil or for DuPont or, you know, whatever name your evil capitalist corporation, you know, if I say, hey, hand me the wrench, the other guy doesn't say, yeah, what do I get? You know, you allocate resources in terms of who needs it and who actually can do what they can do. So communism, in a sense, is the essence of all forms of cooperation, but it's also the essence of all forms of sociability. I mean, if there's someone that I don't, you know, isn't my enemy, who I'm not actively opposed to, well, there is an assumption that on some basic level, of course, we will behave on the basis of from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. That is, if the need is great enough, you know, I'm drowning. Throw me a life preserver, or the cost is small enough, you know, directions, do you have a light? Well, of course we're going to do that. We're not going to keep account. And in those relations which are most important to us, which are characterized by love and actual caring, well, we do the same thing. We take into consideration each other's needs. We take into each other's abilities, but you know, we don't actually keep account of who gave what to whom. And one reason we do that is because we assume that those relationships are going to be around forever. You know, your best friend will always be your best friend. You don't have to keep track of who's done who a favor. Your mother, it's always, well, your mother's not always going to be there, but you imagine relations like that as if they are eternal. They're always going to be there. Society itself is always going to be there, so you don't have to keep track of how many people have held doors for you and how many you've held doors for. So in that sense, almost all relations are founded on this assumption of communism. And in many societies, incidentally, you know, that idea of, like, you know, give me a light, extends to much more important things, food. There are many parts of the world that if you ask someone for some food, you basically can't refuse. I always like the story, there's this Maori story from New Zealand. this guy named Teranga, who, I mean, it's probably apocryphal, but used to go around every day and, like, go by the beach and watch people fishing. And when they came back, he would say, wow, you got some squid? Wow, I love squid, you know? And, of course, they'd have to give it to him. He just do this every day and drove everybody crazy. So after about 5 years, they killed him. Because you can't actually say, no, I'm not going to give you the squid. So in a sense, like, you know, we're all communists. We're all already communists. And to me, I mean, rather than thinking of capitalism and communism as two counterposed principles, I think capitalism is simply a really bad way of organizing communism. Communism will always be here. What we need to do is to figure out ways to organize communism that will not make it turn into social hierarchies.
And that's David Graeber speaking about the communism of everyday life in an interview that I did with him about his book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. Andrei Gribicic, you mentioned that David Graeber was a scholar who was not welcomed by academia. And of course, he was also a scholar who was not home in academia for sort of deep political and even personal reasons coming out of the working class himself. But he was effectively blacklisted after Yale refused to renew his contract. And no university would hire him, but of course he was snapped up, as you mentioned, by prestigious universities in the UK, first Goldsmiths and then the London School of Economics. I wonder if you could talk about his deep radical commitments, which obviously absolutely inform his anthropology. Can you talk about his anarchism and the importance of his politics to the radical politics of our time, including the global justice movement and Occupy Wall Street?
Well, let me try to give you, I hope, a brief biographical sketch. David's life was not very long, unfortunately, but there are certain distinct phases in his life that I think are important to mention. The first is his childhood. And in his childhood, I met his brother Eric and his mother Ruth. And this was a household that was very deeply steeped in working class radicalism in New York. And his father fought in Spanish Civil War with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And one of the things that made David, left a tremendous impression on David, is this idea that anarchism, because he started identifying as anarchist very early on, is something that's a legitimate position, political option to have. It's like when you're in Europe. In the United States, it's slightly different to explain that, but in Europe, most people do believe that, even when they disagree with anarchism, that anarchism is a very normal political position. So his father, who was stationed near Barcelona, he have seen how Barcelona and the countryside near Barcelona were self-managed.
This is during the Spanish Revolution.
During the Spanish Revolution in 1936. And he was able to see that anarchism was actually possible and it was not crazy. So David had no reason not to be an anarchist in a certain sense. And when he was examining different problems with productivist Marxism, the dominant Marxism, orthodox Marxism, that pushed him in the direction of anarchism. And one of the conversations that he had with his father was about anarchist unions. And his father had this remark that anarchist unions always demanded less hours, while Marxist unions always wanted more or higher wages. And that left a serious, I think, David was very influenced by it. And for most of his life, he believed that the way that capitalist system control us or exercises its influence on us is through morality of work and morality of debt. And much of his work needs to be examined in this context, I think. David, then there was the Chicago years of his life, including his trip and 2 years in Madagascar, where he actually really became an anarchist in an interesting way. Namely, he discovered that people in Madagascar, in rural Madagascar, where he was doing his ethnography, were practicing anarchism. And this influenced him deeply because he started to understand anarchism not as an intellectual tradition, but as a logic of practice, or an ethics of practice, as she called it, as a certain kind of common sense that you can find whenever people are ignoring the state. He, in his book that is still my favorite book of his called Possibilities, he writes about this in an essay called Provisional Autonomous Zone, when he is trying to understand how people are collectively making decisions and how they're actually pretending that the state exists, even they're fully aware that state has a very random presence in Madagascar. After this, and I think result of his work in Madagascar, are two books. One book is Lost People, which was published later on. The other book was the book that made him think and write about value, and that's the book that I already mentioned, Towards an Anthropological Theory of Value. Then the third, so to speak, discrete phase in David's life and intellectual life and political life are the anarchist years or the years of anti-globalization movement, so after 1998. David was involved in Seattle, but also even more in all the actions after Seattle. He was part of a group called Direct Action Network, the New York chapter. And much of this inspired him to write a book that became very famous, although it was only a pamphlet, commissioned by Marshall Sahlins and Chicago University Press. Finally, the name was The Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, in which he did say what you just mentioned, that anarchist anthropology does not really exist, but for one particular reason. David hated being called anarchist anthropologist because he didn't really like these nouns. He believed that anarchism is about verbs, about practice, about doing. So you are not an anarchist anthropology, he would say, anthropologist. You would do anarchist anthropology. And for him, that was a very important difference. This period of his life, he published, of course, Fragments, which became almost a manifesto for many of the anarchists of that generation. And then after that, there was a new phase in his life, and that was the phase after Yale, when he was pushed out of Yale. He was fired from Yale, and I have to say, Sasha, forgive me if I sound bitter, but not only from Yale. David, and I know this because I was with him and he was writing these applications and receiving these letters, applied to more than 20 academic departments of anthropology in the United States. None of them would shortlist him or, God forbid, offer him a job, even though at the same time David was giving a Malinowski lecture, a great lecture that he has given at London School of Economics, that anthropologists see as the pinnacle of their careers. But he was completely ignored in the United States, and that's why he went very, very, not just disappointed, but heartbroken from the United States to England. And these are his England years. And these England years is when he felt extremely lonely and isolated, and this is where Debt, the book, came from. He was writing that book, and at some point, and I can't remember now the year, I think 2008, 9, 10, there was a huge uprising, student uprising in London and England in general. And it sort of came and went in waves. And David became politically again involved, this time in England. This influenced his writing of that quite a bit. Conversations with students, ability to put his anarchism to use in that particular context. And that led to his Occupy years. And Occupy years are really a sabbatical that he used, that he spent in New York at the time when Occupy movement slightly before and at the time when Occupy movement was happening. That was the time when, that was the phase when David became a celebrity intellectual because of that, because of his work with Occupy movement. And because of two books that he published subsequently, one was The Democracy Project, and the other one was a book called Bull Drops. And at this time of David's life, he was almost everywhere. You can find David in Palestine, you can find him in Germany, and more than anywhere else, you can find him in Kurdistan or in a place called Rojava, Kurdish Rojava, and that was one of the most stable commitments of his later political life, the struggle for the rights of the Kurds to exist and his support of Kurdish revolution in Rojava.
David Graeber really was the most prominent radical intellectual who to come out and support the Kurdish freedom struggle and their attempts to build a liberatory society in the midst of war.
Absolutely. And there was something very important there that reminded him of Spanish Civil War. And as you know, I traveled to Rojava also. And I think that David was absolutely and completely right to recognize that there is a social revolution of great proportions happening in Rojava. That wasn't the only commitment that he had. He also spent a lot of time supporting Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom. And he was very involved in trying to understand how can one of mostly David was always very supportive of the idea of basic income, and that goes way back. I remember having conversations with him about basic income in 2002. He would always say we need two things. We need debt jubilee, we need forgiveness of debt, and we need to find ways to reduce working hours. We need some kind of a basic income. That was also a very important thing.
Right, so a universal basic income as a way of paying people and having their livelihoods not dependent on wages and their labor.
And that you can understand, again, if you go back to Marcel Mauss, who also thought about these things, and the Mauss Group, as it's called, which is one of the more important people involved, is an anthropologist by the name of Alain Carré. They were developing these ideas in the 90s about the universal basic income. So it's a very Maussian idea, if you like. So these are discrete phases of David's life, the American phase, the phase before that, the anti-globalization movement, the Occupy movement. I remember at some point in 2011, I was talking to him and to Emmanuel Wallerstein, and David asked, and David was very influenced by Emmanuel Wallerstein, and especially his idea of the world revolution. And he asked Emmanuel, do you think that his famous argument, Wallerstein's, was that 1968 was a world revolution. David asked, isn't 2011 also world revolution in the way that you're using this term? And Wallerstein said, absolutely. So David believed that 2011 was a world revolution in Wallersteinian sense, namely that it has changed, transformed the nature of our common political sense. He believed that after 2011, people almost everywhere started to question this identification of democracy with the state and started more and more to identify as United States, at least as socialists. And this is something that he maintained was the main legacy of Occupy. And when he said Occupy, he meant global movements of 2010-2012.
I'm speaking with sociologist Andrei Gribicic. He's chair of the Department of Anthropology and Social Change at the California Institute for Integral Studies. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Andrei Gribicic was a very close friend of the acclaimed anarchist and anthropologist David Graeber, who died unexpectedly last week at the age of 59. And one of the last things that David Graeber wrote, perhaps the last essay, was an essay that he co-wrote with you, Andre, on the great 19th century anarchist thinker Peter Kropotkin and his notion of mutual aid. And I wonder if you could tell us what you and David Graeber argue in that essay.
Yes, I will just, before answering, David had two other works that are going to be published. One is a book with David Wengrow, which is going to be called The Dawn of Everything. And the other is a book called Anarchy in a Manner of Speaking. That was a working title, which is a book of conversations. But in this essay that we wrote together, which was intended as an introduction to mutual aid edition, the new edition of mutual aid, the idea was it brings me back, in a certain sense, actually, to the time when I met David, which was either 1998 or 2000. I think it was 1998. And I think you will understand some things through this anecdote about David and about what was his sort of lifelong commitment. Namely, we met in somewhere in West Village in New York, and we were comparing notes. That was the first time we met. Loud bar, and we were talking about the problem of the gift. I was always inspired by Kropotkin. David, as I mentioned, David was always inspired by Marcel Mauss and the gift. So for me, mutual aid was this building block. For David, it was the concept of the gift. And we were completely horrified that the entire social science, the entire academia, the entire critical social theory, and all the social sciences influences by theory are completely dismissing any possibility of generosity, any possibility of actually having feelings that are not cynical about gifting or about helping each other. So instead of generosity, they were focusing on things that are alternatives to explain why we are involved in acts of mutual aid or in the acts of gifting. And that was absolutely fascinating to both of us. And we came to a conclusion in that conversation that we do need to create a new way of approaching theory, a new way of approaching social science, by actually framing it by beginning from the notion of gift and notion of mutual aid, and that we should probably struggle or confront what was probably a strange internalization of the neoliberal cosmology by leftist academics who stopped talking at that time about class, although most of them were professional managerial class people, and all of a sudden talked about everything else, deconstructing everything else, announcing that truth doesn't exist, or the truth is violence, or the man is dead, and you know, all of those things. In those days were very popular, and we were absolutely shocked. So we went back to Marcel Mauss and to Kropotkin. And I think each one of us developed these ideas or spent our life since developing these ideas and trying to ground the notion and idea of social science in the ideas or concepts of mutual aid and gift. And what we were complaining in this essay that you are mentioning is that Kropotkin was completely ignored, the concept of mutual aid, much like the gift, were completely ignored, partly because of the politics and political fights of the day between Marxists and anarchists, or maybe between orthodox Marxists and libertarian socialists. And partly because also radical social theory has inherited some really bad intellectual habits. And, you know, we have started this conversation with David not feeling at home at universities. David loved conversations. And if one was to understand what David was all about, David is about conversations. He believed that at the beginning of everything was the dialogue. He believed that dialogue is the beginning of thinking. When he and I talked about Cartesian problems and all the, you know, the big changes that were created by Descartes and all of that in the way that we think about philosophy, he would always say, what's really most vicious legacy of that is the separation between individual consciousness and between conversation, between dialogue. And David always insisted that we need to ground our thinking in dialogue. And through dialogue, you gain the idea of individual consciousness. With Descartes, as with the church, the Christian church before that, you begin with individual consciousness and then you move to dialogue. And one of the reasons why David was so attracted to anarchism was because of the idea of conversation, the idea of practice, and the idea that we are dealing, when we speak about anarchism, with a completely different political ontology, as he would say, than when we talk about Marxism, say. If you talk about, when he said Marxism, he always meant orthodox, conventional Marxism. And when you think about conventional Orthodox Marxism, you usually think about the ways that you can define reality and then try to change it. When you think about anarchists, David always said it starts with practice. Anarchism is a community of practice and not a community of definition. It doesn't matter if we are the working class, if we are the multitude, you don't begin with a definition. You begin with a problem. And he would say, and there is a beautiful essay in his book, Possibilities, called Oppression. He would say, you know, people go to a place, people rebel against something that they see and conceive as oppression. While doing that, they imagine all sorts of possibilities. And in that light, they change their attitudes and practices. And he had this very elegant definition of anarchism. He said anarchism is a constant movement between a vision, between practices, and within attitudes. It's never one of those things. It's all three. So for David, dialogue, practice, logic of practice was absolutely everything. And he was able to see that in Kropotkin, and he was able to see that in Marcel Mauss. So in that preface that you mentioned, or in that essay, we went back to Kropotkin's sentence in Mutual Aid, when he says that the task of radical intellectual is to go back and re-examine the history with the help of ethnography, and look a little bit closer at the institutions that used to bring people together, instead of focusing only at the institutions that drove them apart. And that was something that David would always say. He would say, I am so interested in the past, because the way that we are talking about the past is preventing us to be able to imagine the future.
And one of the ways that comes out in his thinking and comes up in that essay to the new edition of Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, is about the Native American thinker Kondiaronk.
That discovery belongs to this phase of David's intellectual life or work, developed together with David Wangro, when two of them started with, and David worked like this, that was the strength of David's thinking. He would look at something that doesn't appear to be a problem, and he would make it an interesting problem. He looked at the problem of social inequality, and he looked at Rousseau. And he said, okay, there is this, the Academy of Dijon, Rousseau wrote about the origins of social inequality. But why social inequality, and what are the origins? Why the origins? So they started writing about the origins of social inequality. And what David and the other David realized in the process of doing that was that there is no such thing, and that social inequality is exactly the wrong way of formulating the problem. So in way to understand how this came about, David went to Kondiaronk, the Native American, extremely cosmopolitan indigenous figure who was involved in conversations, I believe, in Montreal with the governor, and with whom he had a series of fascinating conversations about different institutions. And David says, well, you know, it is Kondiaronk who actually invented the concept of social inequality by speaking about freedom. He was saying, you know, you have all of these ideas, you have all of these institutions, like punitive, regulative institutions. He was telling this to the Jesuits and to the French. Because you have some other institutions, like the institution of money and private property, that necessitate the existence of prisons and punishment and all of that. And there was a certain Baron Lachontan, I think it was his name, who was taking notes, and who I think might have even arranged that meeting. And by taking notes, he did something, and he had to leave. I think he had to flee North America, and he ended up in Amsterdam. And in Amsterdam, he started writing, and he made this book about these conversations. And this book was apparently a huge bestseller, if that's the word to use, in the world of the Enlightenment. And everybody in France knew it. And then there was this woman named Madame de Graffigny, who was one of the famous salon figures of the time, who wrote a book, Peruvian Letters, about an imaginary Peruvian princess, Inca princess, who comes, and this was a very common topic in those days, she comes to French society and she is concerned about the inequality and problems that she's seeing there. And she delivers a critique, a searing critique of European or French society. And she says at some point, why don't you just distribute all the wealth? And David was able to find a correspondence between her and Turgot, in which Turgot and later Adam Smith reiterated this. David used to call this the smoking gun that he discovered. They said, yeah, sure, but let's attach to this idea of equality, let's attach to this the idea of stages of development. And then all of a sudden there was a Rousseau. And Rousseau, when he was writing his Origins of Social Inequality, he was thinking about two things. First is the indigenous critique of European society. Second was the idea of stages of development. And he tried to fuse and synthesize the two, in a sense. By doing that, David insists he created the possibilities and, in a certain sense, framed the European left ever since. But the main point, and I think what you wanted to ask me with this, was that the idea of social equality was a reaction to indigenous critique of European societies of the time. So that's where Candia Ronk comes in, and that's where Baron Lafontaine, who wrote these conversations and published them, and Madame de Graffigny and all of these characters that David read, they all come in into this part of the story, because, and this is something that I don't think people know about David, the last couple of years, he was, when he finished both jobs, the book, he was trying to explore a really interesting connection between freedom, play, and care. And he delivered a fantastic speech at the Collège de France, where he spoke about care and freedom. He was objecting to the term of egalitarianism, or terms like inequality. He said completely meaningless. They're just reproduction of the liberal technocratic jargon. It's not about moving things here and there. It's about destroying the whole bloody thing. So we should speak about freedom. And for people who have been trained within American universities in the last couple of decades, that's a very unusual thing, because we have stopped talking about freedom. People started talking about autonomy and other things, but not about freedom.
No, in fact, we leave that to the right.
Exactly. And David wanted to reclaim freedom in the spirit of his anarchism, of course. This is lifelong intellectual and political fascination. But also because he thought that if we look at these societies that we admire, if you look at these qualities that we admire of these indigenous societies, they're not egalitarian societies, they're free societies. The problem is not who has more wealth. The problem is how that wealth has been transferred to power or transformed into power. And he was trying to understand them as free societies. Now, David was deeply influenced by what we might call feminist ethics of care. And he redefined care and freedom in this essay that I'm referring to in a really interesting way. He believed that care is a way of maintaining somebody else's freedom. So he would say, if you think about a mother and if you think about a child, what does mother care really is about? It is about providing for the child and also making it possible for child to play. And I remember asking him to play, but this is the old Fourier, and this is, where does the play come in? And he says, listen, play is the ultimate exercise of freedom. It is the most sophisticated form of freedom. Because what play is a self-directed activity that creates its own rules. And freedom is exactly that tension between play, free, self-directed creativity, and rules that that play generates, and the tension between the rules and the play itself. Care is a supportive activity in all of this. And that was really interesting, and we spent many, many hours talking about this, and I think that he was on to something very interesting, his Bujrab books. But the thing that people miss about that book, when they usually, not all of them, of course, is his idea that we should stop talking about production and consumption. Instead, we should start talking about freedom and care. It's a fascinating idea.
Indeed it is. And we're going to turn now to an interview that I did with David Graeber in 2018 about the arguments that he makes in The Dawn of Everything, which hasn't been published yet. In fact, it will be published next year, co-authored with David Wengrow. Clearly, we live in times where what people tend to expect for the future is not particularly sunny. Obviously, global warming adds to that, but also the sense of the possible, the politically possible, given the past and the recent past. And one aspect of that, which actually global warming has a part to play in, is this notion that we might be able to live in a way that is more equal, more free, and also more sustainable. And
the degrowth, for example.
Right. And so the implication is, no, it is not possible on the sort of scale that we all live in to be able to live differently. And the only way to even consider it would be a radical scaling back. It sounds like you're mounting a defense of the ability for us to live in radically free and egalitarian ways on a large scale.
Yeah, because this happened before. And you know, it's the evidence is right in front of our eyes, and we just refuse to see it. You know, here you have these giant egalitarian cities that used to exist not that far away, you know, and we're just sort of saying, no, that can't be true. That didn't happen because it can't, you know, it's similar to when I talk about the BS jobs. You'll have people say, well, we have a market system, so nobody would hire someone to what isn't economically advantageous to them. So therefore, the fact that 40% of the population feels they're doing pointless jobs, they must all be wrong. Can't be happening because, you know, our basic picture of the way society works says it can't be happening, so it isn't. I don't care what empirical evidence you put in front of my eyes. It's very similar with history. We just don't see what's in front of us. There's all the negative space in the picture. You know, if you just flip it around, the picture looks really different. One thing that David Wengrow points out, he's worked on a lot of work in Egypt. He says, no one's quite sure how to do the numbers, but there's what they call interdynastic periods. Interdynastic periods is when they didn't actually have a pharaoh. It's like the interregnum. You assume that's like 10, 20 years, but actually no. There's like several hundred usually. And in fact, it's quite possible that there's more interdynastic periods than there are dynastic periods in ancient Egyptian history. In other words, for like at least half the time, there was no pharaoh. There was no giant monuments being built. So what were they doing then? We just ignore that. You know, why don't we write a history of Egypt in which pharaohs are the exception, and normally they're just getting on with their lives without them? So there's a lot more happening in history than we imagine. And if we go back, we discover that social possibilities are much, much richer than we would be inclined to imagine.
And that's David Graeber. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with longtime close friend of David Graeber's, Andrei Grubicich, who is also a co-author with David Graeber. Let me end, Andrei, by asking you about David Graeber's optimism. These are unquestionably dark times, and that tends to color the tenor of much writing on the radical left. What motivated David Graeber's optimism?
He was a tremendously generous person. He was often disappointed in people, but he loved people in a very genuine way. And he would see acts of what he would call everyday communism or baseline communism everywhere around him. He was able to, with a very keen eye and very open heart, he was able to see all of those actions and practices, acts of people's generosity, always around him. when I would see something that was depressing and problematic, he would always try to see that in a way that actually, and he was right, showed something else. David was doing exactly what we wrote about in that essay. We have all been trained to focus on things that are wrong, focus on things that are deepening our relationship with hierarchy and exploitation and domination. And we have been completely, and through the system of education, he would usually say this was beaten out of us, to see acts of small acts of generosity and everyday communism in which everybody gives according to their ability or takes according to the need. And he was able to identify them everywhere. So his optimism was genuine and his optimism was infectious. You could not not be optimistic about life, about possibility of social revolution and social change when you were around David. But I think this is what we need to learn from David. Probably the most important lesson is to, we end this essay by saying that communism is all around us. We just need to start paying attention. And this is what we need. If we understand communism as everyday communism, as these practices, communistic practices and not property arrangements, it is truly all around us. And we need to start paying attention. And that, I think, will help us see possibilities far more clear. And if there is one word that describes David, it's the word possibilities. He was always able to see possibilities, and he used anthropology in order to identify these possibilities. But he also was, in his own life, able to see possibilities everywhere. And this is something that I think we really should learn from David. And I'm very grateful to have been his friend and for being able to learn all of that for almost longer than 20 years from him.
Andrei Gribicich, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Andrei Gribicich is a sociologist and chair of the Department of Anthropology and Social Change at the California Institute for Integral Studies. He's a close friend of David Graeber, the acclaimed anthropologist and anarchist who died unexpectedly last week. Graeber, of course, was the author of many books, including Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and a book whose title we can't say on the radio, but which can be abbreviated to Bold Jobs. He and Andrei Gribicich were the co-authors of An Introduction to Peter Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, a new edition published by PM Press. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say I have a connection to PM Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.